Hi, everyone. Welcome to the A6NZ podcast. I'm Sonal. And today, Michael and I are in Washington, D.C., and we are doing our very first of our podcasts on the road, our second road trip from the U.K. last year. And our first guest that we're honored to have is Ezra Klein.
How's it going?
Hi. And Ezra is the editor-in-chief of Vox. Previously, do you want to just tell us a bit about your background and how you came today to where you are?
Well, in the beginning, I was a small child. Yeah, so I'm currently editor-in-chief of Vox because I'm on a podcast. I'm also a podcaster. I have the Ezra Klein Show where I do interviews with folks. But path-wise, I was at the Washington Post previously where I founded and ran Wonk Blog, which was a policy-heavy section, digital only. And I was a contributor to Bloomberg View and a policy analyst at MSNBC. Before that, I was at the American Prospect. And before that, I was a pretty early blogger. Back when saying the word blog was a really weird thing to do.
Right.
And people looked at you funny and asked you what you were talking about. And so those were good times.
Tell us a little bit about how you have made this transition. I mean, you've gone from being like totally independent to being essentially a media entrepreneur. How has that been for you?
Accidental at almost all levels. So I did not ever intend to become a journalist. This is a slew of surprises for me in my life. When I started a blog, it wasn't something you did because it was a career path. I began a blog in my freshman year of college at UC Santa Cruz. It was 2003. I had been rejected from an internship on my school newspaper. So it's not like my journalism skills were in high demand. But I caught blogging at a really good moment when there was a big first mover advantage. I did an internship at the Washington Monthly, which is a DC magazine, but also had blogs and, you know, was part of that world.
Kind of cutting edge, actually, even back then to have blogs.
Yeah. And that, I think, was sort of the key thing for me and for a bunch of people who were in my cohort. Matt Iglesias, who's a co-founder of mine at Vox, is another, but there are many more. I was in a space where you had small publications were beginning to look at blogging, which was particularly if you're an opinion-oriented publication, blogging was beginning to compete with you pretty directly. And so they decided, hey, we need some people who know how to do this. And because I was a college student, young and cheap were pretty much my primary qualifications for a job. And so I was very lucky to come in at a time when you could get noticed, but also very lucky to be at a stage in my life, which is different than people who had families or people who were academics, where I could go take a very, you know, internships or very low paid jobs and use that apprenticeship or training to learn skills that blogging alone wasn't teaching me. So I went to the American Prospect and became a writing fellow, and I kept blogging. But at the American Prospect, I learned how to report. I learned how to structure a magazine story. I learned how to edit. I learned a lot more of the traditional journalistic skills. And I think that something that has been really lucky in my career is I've had the opportunities and then I think have had the ability to merge a bunch of those techniques.
Do you think that part of your success as an early blogger was that you were focused on not only one area, but broadly speaking, like policy and politics?
And by the way, when you didn't intend to become a journalist, what was your intention? Were you going to be a policy analyst?
It's hard to say no. So policy, again, is another thing that I fell into. It wasn't a pre-existing interest, although I did recently go back and see some columns I wrote for the alternative school paper at Santa Cruz called Fish Wrap Weekly.
Back up. If you know UC Santa Cruz, the fact that it even has an alternative newspaper is very alternative.
City on a Hill Press, the student newspaper. That's the establishment.
So let's also talk about the name.
It needs an alternative. Yeah, because newspapers used to be Fish Wrap. But I was looking back at them, and this is before I would have told you I was interested in policy. And I was surprised to find that during the 2004 election, my columns were actually pretty policy heavy. Early on, I was writing as a lot of people were back then about the Iraq war, and my opinions on that were disastrously wrong and bad. But policy came, I'd say for me, this sort of origin story. And again, I note the Fish Wrap bit because I'm not sure this origin story is true. But I got interested in a healthcare proposal released, I think in 2005, by the Center for American Progress. And so I wrote it up a bit. And then I noticed in my comments a lot of people arguing about the Canadian system and the British system. And I thought to myself, I don't know anything about the Canadian or British systems. And so I did this series where I actually went, I was at UCLA at this point. I went to the library. I checked out a bunch of books on international healthcare policy. And I wrote up what, you know, I recognize now in retrospect is really Wikipedia summaries of how other countries' healthcare systems worked. And I called it the Health of Nations. And it was just like, here's how the British system works. looks. Here's how the Canadian system is structured. Here's how Japan looks. And it was very, very popular. But more than that, it was a lot of fun. It just was much more interesting than the other things I'd been doing. And that, at least the way I understand my own path, and again, recognizing that I'm not sure my memory is infallible here, was what sort of took me in a different direction.
Why couldn't people have gone to a Wikipedia article to get a summary like that? Like, what itch were you scratching?
So one, at that point, Wikipedia is not as comprehensive as it is now. So it wasn't that there were good, or at least I didn't find good summaries of these systems there and just not use them. They just weren't there. I was creating a resource I couldn't find. And I think something that has been consistent in the way I approach policy writing is that I actually like to take the reader on my own journey of learning. So what I find fun about it is actually not the writing. I'm not somebody who got into writing because it makes me feel super alive or something. I don't think I'm a very good writer, actually, on a sentence level. A lot of my friends, certainly my wife, are a lot better than I am. What I am, I think, good at doing and interested in doing is structuring questions and finding the answers to them, kind of figuring out where is the core bit of uncertainty. I'm often looking for what is the question on which a debate turns. What is a question that if you come to this answer versus that answer, you get a different total policy recommendation. And so, you know, as I tried to figure out an area like healthcare, one great thing about blogging, and particularly blogging at that time, was it could be very provisional. I could just learn about things. I could, in a way that did not bespeak or try to assume any kind of authority, just summarize think tank papers I read. I could write things up that ended up being wrong. Something I really miss in writing right now is, as my career has progressed, now I run Vox, I have to write in a way where the writing has to have more authority to it. I can't just be wrong all the time. Or if I am wrong, it has to be wrong in socially acceptable, reputational protecting ways. And that's actually a lot less fun for me. It means that learning about things is much more difficult because you can't just take the readers along with you as you try to figure things out. And it turns out, oh no, that wasn't the answer. You just hadn't read the next paper. But back then I could do that. And so I think that blogging allowed me to do that in a provisional, iterative, and often very nerdy way, in a way that was not built to scale, not built to go viral. But that built up an audience and it built up a reputation.
You sound exactly like Chris Dixon, one of our partners, who's also an early blogger.
It's terrible. And Chris is one of my favorite writers at Andreessen Horowitz, too.
Oh, that's great to hear. So, you know, you mentioned some questions that were preoccupying you at the time and that you were writing was a journey to ask and answer those questions. What are some of the questions that are top of mind for you right now, like especially in the policy and tech side?
All the questions that are really top of mind for me right now are, how do you manage people and how do you make money? the old simple days when I just thought about policy sound really idyllic. But in terms of so right now, the questions I am structured around, that my own personal work is structured around, are less immediate than they used to be. I've become very interested in the question of productivity and technology.
Oh, we love that topic.
Yeah, a lot of people
hear your
are really
thoughts.
Wrong about it. Just like astonishingly wrong about it.
So what are they wrong about and why do you think you're right?
So I don't think I'm right. I don't think that we know that much. I think that I have a couple current opinions. I've not finished my reporting here, so this is provisional. But Mark Andreessen, Bill Gates, are a bunch of folks out there who are absolutely certain, because they look around them, that there is a tremendous advance in technology that is simply not being caught up in productivity statistics. There are other people I should note, also in Silicon Valley, like Peter Thiel, who do not believe this.
Which is to say that the productivity is there, it's just not being measured.
Yeah, so there are a couple versions of this argument when you begin to break it down. One is that there's, as you say, productivity mismeasurement. Everybody agrees that productivity is always mismeasured. There is no doubt about that. The question is there reason to believe it is more mismeasured now than it has been before?
Because of software, in our view.
Because of software, yes. There have been a lot of careful analysis of this now, including by Chad Syverson, which is a paper I recommend people really interested in this look up. You can get, you know, some amount of money out of mismeasurement. The problem is it's very hard, even with incredibly optimistic underlying assumptions, to get very much. And the other thing is that, how do we know we weren't being terribly mismeasured before, when we invented the toilet, when we invented the automobile, when we invented the jet plane? There's a lot going on here that is productivity statistics have, if nothing else, been consistent. And a lot of the arguments you get into, like, oh, nobody's correctly measuring the value of my phone because I spend all this time on it, but it didn't cost me that much money. Look how much time people spend on televisions. It was hours and hours of their day, and televisions also were not that expensive and kept getting cheaper and kept getting better. Look at how much time people spent in cars. Look at how much time they spend being around their family. I mean, it's on telephones. I mean, we have always had this problem. Then you have another set of arguments, right? Which is productivity is not measuring the right thing.
The big difference between the examples you just shared and software is that it's this question of the dematerialization of the goods, which is that a car, there's two ways to look at the car. Like, there's a car that was this mechanical object. There's a car today that is more soft, that is increasingly becoming more software than hardware. And then you actually have just pure software that is not in any kind of physical form. Like, do you not buy the dematerialization of good arguments?
I don't think that, I definitely buy that we are dematerializing our goods. I don't buy that it's all that important. And I don't think there's a reason to think it would be that important. But think about this another way in terms of what we are, because one thing that I think is problematic, and my colleague Matt Iglesias has made this point, I think it's a really important point for this debate. There is a technical economic concept called productivity. That technical economic concept is really important for a lot of other things in the economy, but it's not the only thing that matters. And in a bit of linguistic imprecision, we often let it stand in for technology. You can have technology advancing and it doesn't do anything for productivity. And clearly, to some degree, we have that. I'm not sure we have it more than we have at other times, but we clearly have it to some degree. But the thing about productivity mismeasurement, the argument to me that I can't get away from, is if what we were seeing was really a problem in productivity numbers, I would want to see the effects of increasing productivity showing up in other indicators. So maybe we're not measuring productivity
but
well,
it's
but we're measuring wages perfectly well, and they're not going up. Maybe we're not measuring productivity well, but we're definitely measuring the number of Americans who are employed perfectly well, and that's really not in great shape. Maybe we're not measuring productivity well, but we are able to poll people and say, do you think things are on the right track? Do you think the country is on the right track or wrong track? How do you think your children will be richer than you are?
Are you talking about self-reported polling?
Now I'm talking about self-reported polling.
Why would that be any more valid than anything else?
So what I'm saying is that you can imagine a world where we're having tremendous productivity increases that are not being tracked. What you would imagine to see in that world, though, is the reason we care about productivity increases is that they grow the economy. They lead to higher wages. They lead to more jobs. They lead to people feeling like things are getting better. We are not seeing any of that either. And that makes productivity mismeasurement, in addition to all the technical arguments against it, very unlikely to me. So you're now talking about a kind of productivity that is not leading to any of the things that we care about productivity for.
Right. So if productivity is sort of this series of inputs, at some point the outputs are what we recognize and what we have always looked toward. And productivity as an input where it's just productivity swirling around and being more productive, but it doesn't translate to these things that you're describing, I can see how that would give people pause.
Right. When you talk to folks about why they care about productivity, they'll say if we had productivity between 2005 and 2014 that we had in the 10 years prior to that, we know that output isn't there. Right, whatever we're mismeasuring, it's not that we're not finding output. We know the wages that we would expect from that output, the jobs we would expect from that output didn't come. So that's where whatever is going on in technology, and a lot of great things are, the questions that productivity is structured to ask and the outcomes it is that we care about it leading to, they are not happening in the economy.
Do you think that's partly, though, also, I think we're living in an incredibly interesting time in terms of technological change, but that we're in this in-between period where people are just, we're in that troubling period where it hasn't quite shifted, to your point. Like, it hasn't quite shifted to people making jobs. And the other thing I'd add to this is that our palette in the past, or our canvas has really been the US, and which is the point. But we're also talking here about maybe those productivity shifts are happening globally. And that's what's completely different than any time before. And be able to sort of distribute that. I mean, I don't mean to put a red herring in this.
We are seeing, by the way, a global productivity slowdown, at least in developed countries.
Well, I'm talking about the developing countries for sure.
I think you get to something super important, which is there is a pessimistic and an optimistic version after you sort of put aside the mismeasurement thesis. The pessimistic version, which you're seeing from some economists like Tyler Cohen, like Robert Gordon, is we are in an extended and likely persistent technological slowdown where we have picked a lot of the easy fruits of technological advancement. And while it's awesome that things we can do on screens are getting so much better, We are, in Peter Thiel's formulation, we're not moving faster. We're not anymore seeing big gains in life expectancy, that all sorts of other areas that used to be things we called technology are not moving. So that's the scary version. The less scary version, the happier version, is to say, okay, there is some deep feeling of confusion here, because we look around us and we seem to be seeing all these advances. We seem to be hearing about all these advances, but we're not seeing them show up. And what is possible is that we are in a deployment phase. That a
in
lot
the Carlota Perez sense.
A lot of things have happened. A lot of innovations have been made. We have discovered quite a bit that's going to be important. But for some reason, deployment is slowed down. There's actually some evidence behind this too. And this is a place where I want to be a little careful, because I'm really digging into this and I don't understand it.
That's
perfectly
okay.
Well,
this
yet.
Is a provisional blogging podcast.
Right. But it's an interesting argument. And if the argument is correct, it would imply we're going to see faster than average productivity growth starting who knows when. And then you'll talk to people like Bill Gates, who's on my podcast a while back and talked about this. And I mean, his view is that the stuff that is being discovered now, you're going to see this convergence of AI, of material research.
That's actually my view too on this. I think there's going to be this compounding. We're actually at the very beginning. Like when people talk about the mobile phone and this arrival, it's not the end, it's the beginning, and the compounding effect hasn't even begun yet.
So the thing there is that which of those you believe, I think, structures how optimistic or pessimistic you are. I do want to note that saying like it's coming, we're sure, isn't of much help to someone who's living in Ohio and lost their manufacturing
job. I totally agree with that.
The hard part there is we just don't know. The really, really difficult part there is we just don't know. And I am excited about things like AI, but deployment phases can be very, very, very long.
That's right.
And they can go in directions that we're not expecting also. Then there's a question of headwinds, right? The American economy's demographics are not unbelievable right now. There are questions of what we're going to do with immigration. There's also issues, the quality of our governance. What is going to happen that would hold things back that might otherwise happen that are very positive? So the place that I am trying to figure out is I'm not at all convinced by mismeasurement. But I do take seriously the fact that things feel very different than what we're seeing. One thing that would explain feels very different than we're seeing is a disconnect between innovation and deployment. But the fact that we're seeing them does not make deployment easy. So I've spoken with Chris about the full stack startup arguments. The reason I'm interested in arguments around full stack startups is they speak to this debate.
Oh, that's they an interesting are, angle.
If you go into places where most people actually work, which is not Facebook, if you go into a retail store, if you go into the back of a restaurant, right? If you go and check out what some home healthcare aides, you just don't see their work changing tremendously from 10 or 15 years ago. It's just not been upended that much. One thing that we, I think, have found is that inventing cool new software actually is not the answer. That in order for a lot of these cool new software companies to begin to change their markets, workflow
totally
is much, much tougher than people realize. Yeah. And so the rise of some of these full stack startups like Uber is interesting to me because it speaks to one mechanism by which deployment will happen. That yes, we've had tremendous advances in software, but one reason deployment doesn't happen is that grafting those onto existing businesses is harder and less certain than people thought. The full stack players, they create businesses from the ground up that are built around how you do how you use the software. And I see this in Vox, like we built to use new software, and I realize how hard it is even having built an organization specifically for that purpose. So to do that at an organization that is not built for that purpose is very, very, very challenging.
Well, something else you're alluding to, something we talk about a lot on our podcast, among many different guests, is that it does also reinvent the organizational structure that forms around it.
But you also see the pressure that when whatever the vertical is, whether it's transportation like Uber and Lyft, or if it's retail or something, when those full stack, you know, instantiations come out and are super successful, the pressure on the folks that aren't that way just ratchets up, you know, massively. And you start to see things change quickly, I think, in sort of verticals and in silos. And maybe that's the deployment phase where, you know, you need the first couple of examples and boom, there it goes in transportation, and boom, there it goes in healthcare. But you know.
Right. I mean, although I do suspect different industries are going to be different. I am definitely waiting for the whoop, there it goes in healthcare.
Yeah.
Healthcare is a fascinating sector that is simultaneously incredibly technologically advanced and then very, very, very resistant to new technologies. They will like fire proton beams at your cancer, but then they will write down what they did on paper and file it in a large cabinet.
There's a lot more existing processes in place to approve hardware than there is to navigate software. I mean, that difference you just described boils down to hardware and software, atoms and bits.
My colleague, Matt, has made an interesting argument where he argues that one thing that led to the big advances for Uber was that it was sort of a regulatory hack. It wasn't just software. It's that it created space in a area that was consumer-facing and incredibly, incredibly badly regulated, incredibly subject to regulatory capture, which is ride-hailing, to really upend that. Question of how many of those there are is difficult. Healthcare, obviously, is incredibly regulated, but people get very, very, very upset when they take a medicine that kills them. It may not prove to be the case that consumer pressure in healthcare is in the same direction. So I think that there are reasons for optimism, and there are arguments that will lead you to more optimism, but I think it is worth taking them with some caution. Those of us who have benefited from this economy are going to be very likely to say this economy is good, right? That it's actually much better than people realize. And I think it's important to be conscious of that bias in our perspective.
The perspective that I come from is that I was born and raised in this country, but I come from immigrant parents and we spent a lot of time in India. There's nothing like coming from a place like that or seeing a place like that and then seeing the stark contrast of opportunity in this country that just sort of, not to get all like, you know, platitude-ish about it by any means, but truly, like, I think that provides a really useful contrast. And I think a lot of people are just not exposed. Like they can't even conceive of what their reality is, how different it is than in other places. I am curious to hear your thoughts on that note on immigration, which is a topic that you've talked about a lot.
So I'm also a child of immigrant. My mother is from the States, but my father is Brazilian. And I go back there a lot, as you do. So I am emotionally incredibly pro-immigration. I'm also Californian. I grew up in Southern California. Where I grew up was very heavily Hispanic, very heavily Asian. The diversity of the space I grew up in was an incredibly important part of the culture and a part I valued. I don't have reservations about the cultural changes from immigration. That, to me, is separate from all the arguments about productivity, which I think productivity and economic growth, which I think are absolutely slam dunk. So on immigration, I'm pretty far towards opening up. Like, I don't just think we want to reform the immigration system. I don't just think we want to find a way to create a path to citizenship for unauthorized immigrants. But I think we really want to increase flows to this country by a quite large amount. Now, there are ways to do that that are, I think, smarter and savvier and make more sense than other ways. So it's not that designing smart policies doesn't matter, but I would design policies that would increase inflows quite dramatically, not that would just try to restructure the inflows we currently have or just try to look at it as a problem we currently have to be solved. I see it as a tremendous opportunity. The other thing that I always find funny about this debate is I think it shows a place where intuitions change dramatically depending on words you use. So I think Americans have for some time understood that Europe's lack of low fertility rate is an economic problem for Europe. Japan's low fertility rate is an economic problem for Japan. You read these things like in Japan, adult diapers are now outselling children's diapers. That economy is not going to be in good shape. In America, we've had, you know, higher fertility rates than some of our developed peers. Although again, that too, by the way, is largely due to immigrants. So, but people understand that and they recognize that as a strength for America. And then they look around and they look at immigration, and immigration in an abstracted way is the exact same thing. It is adding more workers to your economy. The reason high fertility rates are good is more workers, more people, more demand.
More entrepreneurship too.
More entrepreneurship. Immigrants do that, and not only that, but it does it in a way where there's actually a little bit less competition with native-born workers. So when you think about competition for jobs, higher birth rates mean, again, quote-unquote, more competition for jobs in a way that adding immigrants, you usually have less competitive labor there. They often fill jobs that otherwise wouldn't be filled or otherwise wouldn't exist. There's a lot of good research out of UC Davis around this. And so it's a place where I think people's intuitions are very strange. We know that it would be good to have more babies for the economy because that means more workers, but our intuitions completely flip when those workers are coming in through a gate.
You know, we're all from California. There's the national discussion on immigration, and then there's what's happening in California and will continue to happen regardless, because that's how immigration occurs in California. It's just not, you know, been put into policy. And yes, some of it, much of it's illegal, but that's just the way that state and that economy and that culture works. And to maybe like learn from that and extrapolate and make it into a more generalized national policy would be interesting, but.
So I think the problem is a lot of the country does not want California's immigration policy. I mean that's in some ways like the core of it. And, you know, and California, I think, doesn't want the nation's immigration policy, right? Well, they don't want all these people to be unauthorized. When you talk about labor competition, one real problem when you have a lot of unauthorized workers is that they can be exploited in a way workers who are within the protection of the law can't. If they begin to unionize or ask for higher wages, you can literally just call the INS and have a raid on your factory. And oops, I didn't know I had all these unauthorized immigrants here. When you're talking about undercutting American labor, like you're talking about that being a much worse situation.
Right. Okay, well, let's briefly talk about politics. What do you think of this view that we're shifting to more of like a European-like model for political parties, where instead of two dominant parties, we now have four parties, you know, like a hard right authoritarian, a hard left socialist, and then the mainstream Democratic Republican parties?
Those two parties have always included more parties than people quite realize. So if you go back to the 80s and 90s, you had New Democrats, right? The wing of the party that Clinton led. You also had the wing of the party that Jesse Jackson led. If you go back before that, there was a continuous governing coalition between conservative Democrats and Republicans, because the Democratic Party included this Dixiecrat faction that was nothing like what you had from, say, you know, Northern Democrats. So the idea that the two parties are going to have distinct wings within them is just not that new. What is new and is increasing is the way that the parties are sorted by ideology. So those distinct wings, previously you had a liberal wing in the Republican Party, a conservative wing in the Republican Party, a liberal wing in the Democratic Party, a conservative wing in the Democratic Party. And when you ran the numbers, when you actually looked at voting coalitions, you had many Democrats who were more conservative than some Republicans, many Republicans more liberal than some Democrats in Congress. Now there are zero crossovers like that.
Yeah, those Dixiecrats are all Republicans now, right?
So there's zero Democrats now who are more conservative than any congressional Republicans. And so what that's done is that you have a liberal party and a conservative party. And that has allowed them to polarize and act as much more unified institutions. And what used to happen is you had these internal coalitions that fractured the party's capacity to act in a unified way. What the liberal Democrats wanted to do was not what the conservative Democrats wanted
exactly
to do. Now, everybody's more or less on the same side and getting further and further and further away from the other side. The way in which we are becoming more like Europe is polarized parties, right? That is how everything else worked. And there are complex reasons we didn't have them in this country, ideologically polarized parties for a long time. The problem is Europe has political systems built for polarized parties. You have parliamentary systems usually that ensure that sort of whoever's majority can govern. We have a political system that is built for non-polarized parties that require very high levels of consensus or compromise to exist across the two parties. And in an age when that compromise is becoming harder and harder and harder to find, the political system is beginning to fracture under the stress. And I think the outcomes of the system are getting worse and worse.
Do you think that's what's explaining some of this? I mean, is this rise of Trump a new phenomenon? I mean, what's going on here?
I always want to be careful confidently proclaiming about Trump, because I did not predict this, and the degree to which you should listen to me is probably limited. But
I will say that when I first saw what was happening, everyone was kind of mocking as if it was a joke. And I was like, why is anyone not taking this more seriously?
What I think you're seeing with Trump, so one, the faction of the Republican Party Trump represents is by no means new. It is the faction that was voting for Pat Buchanan. It's very similar to the pro coalition, which drew not exclusively, but quite heavily from the Republican Party. And I think many of the Democrats who were attracted to pro are now Republicans, or part of that shift over in the South. So this is not new. What is interesting about what Trump is doing is that he is able to completely divorce himself from the party apparatus while running within the party. Usually the party has traditionally suppressed this part of itself, right? The fact that you had a lot of downscale white voters in the Republican Party who like Medicare, who like Social Security, who are happy to tax rich people, who are skeptical of trade, but who are also socially conservative, heavily nationalistic, and very, very upset about immigration. Trump didn't discover that. We knew that. The Republican Party suppressed those kinds of candidates by its control of money, its control of information, its control of who gets taken seriously, of who gets good jobs, of who gets good positions. Trump, for unusual reasons, his media celebrity, his money, et cetera, has been able to subvert all of that. He has both been able to be a candidate on the stage in Republican debates and a candidate hated by the Republican donor class, but still run as a Republican in good standing.
So in all this discussion about that institution being, you know, ripped apart, does it, I mean, and you talked about how, yes, we are European in sort of thought and, you know, kind of ideology, but not in terms of process and structure. Does the structure start to change? I mean, is this the thing that can change the structure? Does the Republican Party like literally get ripped apart?
I don't think so. These institutions tend to be pretty durable. It doesn't mean it can't happen. What will then happen is one of two things. He will either win and he will take over the Republican Party from the inside, or he will lose and the Republican Party will close ranks. And what's going to happen then is Trumpism will survive. He himself is not a movement builder. He will go and like endorse another line of stakes or whatever the hell he does. But there are going to be people who look at this and the next round of ambitious young Republican politicians, and they're going to take parts of Trumpism without Trump, right? They're going to professionalize it. They're going to do it in a way that it is more acceptable to elites, more acceptable to the Republican Party, has less comments, makes fewer incredibly misogynistic comments. And so you're going to see a more elegant version of Trump emerge, which, by the way, I think you'll see in the Democratic Party around Sanders too.
Right.
One of the reasons the two-party system works in this country is the parties end up being, you know, reasonably flexible in terms of their ability to appropriate movements. It's happened before. It'll happen again. And I expect we're in one of those times.
So Ezra, speaking of some of those unusual factors that you were talking about, what do you think of all these confessionals that the media is writing about their own role, its own role in the Trump phenomenon? I mean, you're saying that it phenomenon existed regardless, but Trump being Trump, what's your take on that?
So to some degree, I'm a little unsympathetic to all this, or at least unsurprised. One is that the media has a major role in all elections, and we don't like to talk about it. It has always been the case that the media and who the media covers and how they cover them are a really important contributor in who wins and who does, and who we take seriously from the beginning really matters. The media's coverage of Al Gore, I think, really contributed to him losing the election in 2000. The media not giving a damn about all kinds of candidates has strangled all sorts of insurgencies in the crib. Because we in the media, and I use we a little bit loosely here because the site I run and the way I've done my work is a little bit more opinionated, but broadly speaking, the media has in general wanted to portray itself as a completely neutral observer, as simply a reflection of events. But we are obviously a powerful factor, and Trump is forcing, I think, us to reckon with that in ways normally we don't, because normally the candidates we give a lot of attention to, nobody's upset about that, right? That we have found ways to give attention to candidates who are endorsed by their party structures,
right,
who are leading in the
legitimatized,
polls.
Being legitimate, further legitimatized.
In giving a lot of attention to Trump, we have been giving attention to the candidate who is leading in the polls, but is not endorsed by his party structure, right? So that's where some of the confusion comes in, because usually you would have those two things aligned, so there wouldn't be a lot of criticism. Currently, there's a lot of criticism because a lot of Republicans upset about what's happened are trying to blame it on the media as opposed to their own party, which I think really did create conditions for Trump to rise and also did not unify behind any other candidates early. What I think is, if I were to say what I think is interesting about the relationship between Trump and the media, which is clearly, by the way, symbiotic, right? We're both benefiting. Trump is benefiting from media coverage and the media is benefiting from covering Trump. But I think what Trump has figured out, candidates usually believe that bad media coverage is bad. So Trump's innovation, so far as there is one, is that valence of media coverage doesn't really matter. It's not how it, what matters is not how the media covers you, it's whether the media covers you. And he's willing to absorb a tremendous amount of incredibly negative coverage so long as he's getting all of the coverage. And a place where you saw this very vividly, there was a day a couple of months ago when Ted Cruz began leading in the Iowa polls for the first time. Two came out just right at the same time. And all of a sudden it looked like Trump, who'd been, you know, leading in Iowa for so long, maybe he actually was vulnerable. And maybe this was the long expected end of Trump. Cruz would win Iowa. He would blow past Trump. Everything would be different. Donald Trump walks out that day in front of cameras and he does something very unusual. And he unfurls a statement, and Trump never reads from prepared statements. And he says, "I, Donald J. Trump, hereby endorse a complete ban on travel from Muslims to and from the United States." And what he did there was Ted Cruz was about to get all the media coverage. Ted Cruz was ascendant. He was on the rise. Trump came out with something so controversial,
so blatant,
that they made people so angry. He basically rolled a grenade into the middle of the election. And then so all of a sudden, instead of Ted Cruz getting that coverage, all the cameras pivoted right back to Trump. And, you know, he like got yelled at, but he stood up for, you know, his idea. And it was sort of brilliant. And
yeah,
he's done
actually.
This a number of different times. You've seen him begin to sag, and then he'll do something extremely controversial. And you got to remember, this guy's actual experience is not primarily recently as a real estate developer. He's a reality television star. And what you do on reality television is you do crazy and sometimes very upsetting, villainous things to get attention. The people who are successful on reality television are often the ones who went there and were not, quote unquote, there to make friends, right? They did really nasty things to people. The folks who just went and like played nicely, like we can't remember any of their names.
No, we can't.
And Trump has taken the lessons of reality television and taken them to a presidential election. It doesn't matter if you're getting good coverage. It matters if you are the guy in front of the cameras all the time.
Getting the coverage.
And you change the coverage. He also, he learned from Kanye, I think, who's a master at this too, where, you know, people are getting down on Kanye for doing one thing. And then he's like, you know what? I'm running for president. You know? And then all of a sudden, that's all anyone cares
he's
about.
He's setting up his game too. Okay, so one last question then to wrap up. Speaking of media and your role now as the editor-in-chief of Vox, and we started talking about this in the beginning, coming full circle, like what do you think is happening next, not just for you personally, but in this space?
So I'm pretty optimistic about the business, but it is changing. One thing I did not expect was actually how fast some parts of it would change. I think the thing that's going to be it might be great, but it's going to be, I think, difficult, is how much we are going off platform. When we started Vox, a lot of the theories about Vox were about, you know, Vox.com, frankly. When we talked about card stacks and created card stacks are something, and those are a product we have to attach contextual information to our news story. So if you're reading something about, say, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, we can cover the new news in that and then also let you see this set of cards that you can swipe through that give you all the background information. So right. If you've not been following that, you can catch up very quickly. But card stacks cannot be imported to our Snapchat Discover product. They can't be put on at the moment Facebook Instant articles. They're not relevant for a lot of the places people are now discovering our content. And as that happens, as we have less control over the platforms on which we publish, I actually do worry about the way it will choke off innovation. Because all of a sudden, I mean, let's say we create a great data interactive, which is something we do a lot at Vox. And that interactive, it can't be in a Facebook Instant article. It can't be on Snapchat. So what do you do in a world where the more complex and innovative some of the work you do is, the smaller the fraction of your audience it can actually reach? So on the one hand, I think that the new platforms are giving us this capacity to reach a tremendous number of people. I mean, we had 99 million Facebook video plays in what was it, February? So that's amazing, the number of people we can now reach. And it's good for our business in very, very profound ways. But in terms of, you know, inventing journalism the way we would have invented it if we'd started in the internet age, I do worry that some of that innovation, which really was beginning to happen, really is beginning to happen, is going to get a little choked off.
I just wonder then if, do you need to refocus on distribution? And maybe it's not that you can reach a billion or 2 billion people, but it's that you can reach, you know, the 200 million people that really build an audience and a following and a, you know, cycle of, you know, business for that matter.
One thing that we are becoming, I think that a lot of us are becoming, is super, super multi-platform. One of my favorite stories is we did a video, a 6-minute explanation of the civil war in Syria, which is just an incredible video. And we put it up on YouTube and then we put it up on Facebook. And I put it up, included on my Facebook account, and it did crazy well there. I think it got like 40 million plays. And then there was a guy who was a fan of Vox on YouTube who began tweeting at a bunch of my writers and saying, hey, there's this asshole, Ezra Klein, who is jacking your YouTube videos and putting them on Facebook and is getting all these views and you guys need to do something about it. And this guy was a serious fan of Vox YouTube and just didn't know anything else about Vox. And
oh
that was
God,
great.
Great.
And we see it all the time. Like a lot of our Snapchat audience does not know the other parts of us. They just know us as a Snapchat organization. So that's wonderful. And there's tremendous amounts of innovation happening within these places. But I do think, you know, in terms of what has been different about the business and what is changing about it, not controlling your own platforms, being on so many platforms with so many different publishing right. systems that have so many different both advantages and limitations, means that there is a disincentive to forging forward and really trying to build new things. So when you talk about the full stack questions, we own increasingly less of the stack, right? It is not Chorus, our publishing software, that is putting us on YouTube. It's not Chorus, our publishing software, that is driving our podcast. So that, I think, is one way in which our ability to innovate things and change them is being reduced.
What you find stressful, probably, and promising at the same time as someone who manages and leads an organization around that, I find incredibly exciting as a consumer.
It is really exciting. I mean, we are getting to do more things in more different formats for more people than we ever imagined. It's a way in which I think the media business is getting better, but it is being changed very dramatically. And I don't think we are certain of where these changes will go.
I think time will only tell. Thank you, Ezra, for joining the A6NZ podcast.
Thank you.